Life has its ups and downs, and like many of us, I face moments with depression. Music has always helped me find my way through, and I believe it can do the same thing for you. I'm James Cox, and this is the When Words Fail Music Speaks Podcast, a podcast about the healing power of music.
Hey everybody, welcome back to When Words Fail Music Speaks, where you fight depression with the power of music. I am your professional handicapped host, James Cox, and I have such a great interview today. Some musicians play notes. Others tell stories without saying a word. Today's guest is one of those artists known for his time with Megadeth. Jeff Young lived through one of the most intense chapters in metal history. But his journey, it goes far beyond that spotlight. And it's a story that of finding your voice in the middle of chaos and holding on to who you are when everything around you is moving so fast. Jeff, what's up, buddy? How are you doing?
What an intro. Wow, did you write that? Is that your own intro? That was beautiful.
Thank you so much. Yeah, because I try to find it very positive things, because this is a very positive podcast. We don't like to talk about rumors and innuendos and clickbait stuff, so we're all for that.
And I'm happy to be here.
Yes, sir. Thank you so much. So you're at the house, correct? You're in, where are you at right now? I mean, like, what state?
We're in Boston, right? We just flew in, Kings of Thrash. We went up to Canada. We did 3 gigs. The first one was like a rehearsal because we hadn't rehearsed since we played in Japan a couple months ago. We did Toronto. We did Montreal and Ottawa last night. And that was the best show. I thought last night was pretty magic. We're going to be posting some of that on Kings of Thrash on YouTube.
Yeah.
And then today we woke up and we just flew in to Boston. That was short, just less than an hour flight. And we met our tour bus and we're sitting in a Target parking lot somewhere in Boston. And where are we playing tomorrow night, people? Do we know?
Somewhere.
Hello, Cleveland.
Cleveland Rock.
The Normo Dome. Where? The Vault. The Vault tomorrow night in Boston.
In Redford, Massachusetts.
Redford, Massachusetts.
All right. The Vault. I find these venues to be named so awesomely because in North Carolina they have a venue called Chapel of Bones, and I'm like, how cool is that? You know, the name of your venue, Chapel of Bones. You know, so I do like the Vault also. You know,
so. Do you know the venue?
No, nope. But I am going to the Chapel of Bones and see 6 Feet Under next month. So that'll be really cool. But I've never heard of the Vault.
Which Well, me neither, but I'm sure we won't forget it after tomorrow.
Yes.
The fans have been wild on this tour. Was it Montreal? The people had the guy, he was like doing Jesus Christ pose and hitting the ceiling because it was like a low ceiling.
Right.
It was nuts. And we had some stage divers. And so we're having fun out here.
All good.
It feels like 1987 all over again.
Yes. But let's go back to 1985, if we can for a minute, where you graduated from the Guitar Institute of Technology right there, right?
True story.
Yes. And that's the same institute where a whole generation of shredders came from, right? Do you think that formal training there gave you an advantage, or did it actually create any blind spots for you creatively?
I always like to try to keep a balance between education and learning by ear and keeping it more street and just using your intuition. So I tried to take, you know, what that program had to offer. Half the reason I wanted to go to GIT was A, to attend the school, but it wasn't just about the learning in the curriculum, and it was about the artists who came there, from Eric Johnson to Rush, just so many amazing players came through and played in the school, Steve Morse, and you could sit in the front row and ask them questions. And the teachers that were there at that time, Tommy Tedesco from the Wrecking Crew was still there. Dwayne Day was amazing. Frank Gambale, who went on to play with Chick Corea, he's a huge influence. I still carry the book with me. It's in my backpack right now. Just stapled. It was his first book, so it is all kind of torn apart, and I had to put it in a folder, but I still travel with that same book from 1984 that Frank Gambale wrote. He was a former GIT student. Then he became a teacher, and then he went on to Chick Corea's band and his own solo bands and did some albums with Alan Holdsworth and other luminaries. So, of course, Scott Henderson, one of my favorite guitar players, I think he's still there. I mean, he was cutting heads back in 84, and then I started teaching there, I think in like 2006, and he was still there. We became great friends, and he's a huge influence.
Right. Yeah. Not only are you a big time figure in metal, you love jazz and flamenco music, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm trying to get more into jazz. So could you tell me a little bit about what you collected over the years about jazz, and, you know, because I'm trying to get more and more into jazz. I just can't.
Really, if I had to pick my number two favorite genre,
yeah,
like after rock and what I play now, I'd have to say funk, because I grew up in Dayton, Ohio, where the Ohio Players were from. And that's really where the funk movement was born, in Cincinnati, Ohio, Dayton, even Columbus, Lakeside. So many bands came out of that area, but mainly the Ohio Players. And they were the band that, you know, as a kid, you didn't even understand what it took to get from a small town anywhere, you know, to Hollywood, New York, you know, London, and what it took to catapult to become, you know, an artist like the Ohio Players. But when you see them on American Bandstand and Soul Train, and you know they're from your town, it gives you kind of a pathway or a guide, a signpost, and you go, okay, if they did it, maybe there's a way I can do it. And so funk is a huge influence. And actually, I came into classical, then flamenco second, but it came through rock and the players in rock and prog, like Steve Howe from Yes and Mood for a Day on the Yes album. And he was always a player who incorporated many different styles in Yes's music. And they were one of my favorite bands, so I always tried to keep him in mind. And Steve Morse with the Dixie Dregs, likewise, he played many different styles from rock, blues, jazz, classical, country, and he was equally adept at every style. And I always look to players like that. Eric Johnson is another amazing artist that people like Steve Morse started bragging about. And other players started, there's this guitar player out of Austin, Texas, named Eric Johnson, that you got to hear, because his tone and his phrasing is just otherworldly. So I was lucky to get into these players really early on. And Eddie Van Halen, the first time you really, so Steve Howe, you hear Mood for a Day. And of course, Jimmy Page was even bringing in some acoustic and some flamenco. Babe, I'm Gonna Leave You has very flamenco chord progression and vibes in the rhythm, both in the ballad part and when it picks up into the double time section. So those rock players who were reaching from different palettes were influences. Then when Eddie Van Halen comes out with Spanish Fly on Van Halen 2, which was very flamenco-esque, even though he played it with a pick, that's what he was trying to do. And of course, Little Guitars on Diver Down had a very flamenco feel. And then Randy Rhoads comes out with D on the first Blizzard of Oz album. That's all I needed to hear. I looked around Dayton and found the best classical guitar teacher that I could find. And he was actually amazing. You know, Dayton, he actually was based in Centerville, a suburb of Dayton. But is still lucky. He has a radio show to this day where he promotes classical music and classical guitar. He goes around town and teaches all the kids and young schools, tries to get them into guitar and into music, which is an amazing thing when you think how much music programs have been sliced and diced out of school curriculums in favor of, you know, sports and other more frivolous pursuits.
Yeah. You mentioned Ohio, but not a lot of people knew that you were in Kettering, Ohio first, and then you moved to Hollywood.
Say that again?
You're in Kettering, Ohio, and then you moved
right
to Hollywood. But many people don't.
Exactly. And it happened very simply. You know, and many kids, there wasn't, everybody didn't play guitar back when I started. There was
right.
very few guitar players.
Yeah.
And I was lucky to have a great teacher. My mom, speaking of the Ohio players, where they were from was in East Dayton, which was an hour drive from where we lived in Kettering, Centerville. But I don't even remember how I found this amazing guitar teacher named Bob Schroyer. He played a Gibson Les Paul recording model that I still covet to this day. And he was the guy that taught me how to play the Jimmy Page licks, Over the Hills and Far Away, properly, and Stairway to Heaven. But he was the guy that, you know, when I was only 14, 15, got me into Tommy Bolin, Private Eyes and Teaser Records. And Tommy became one of my favorite guitar players. I really feel my new album, Revolutions, is a harken back to albums like Tommy's, where he had amazing different players, a collage of players, and some instrumentals, some vocal tracks, and again, drawing from a lot of different styles for his fusion. A lot of people don't know, and Jeff Beck even gives credit to Tommy Bolin for his Wired and Blow by Blow albums. He was inspired by Tommy Bolin, and that's what he changed his whole style. If you listen, because there was the tour before Tommy Bolin died, was Eric Clapton, Jeff Beck, and Tommy Bolin, right?
Right.
And when Jeff Beck heard Tommy on that tour, he changed his whole, if you listen to Jeff Beck before he heard Tommy Bolin, and then you listen to Jeff Beck on Wired and Blow by Blow, and then you go listen to Tommy's solo albums, you go, oh, I totally get where this comes from. Right.
Right. Wow. Yeah. Is it possible that we could talk about your, okay, so I read, and this might not be true, but I imagine it is. But it's said that you were in line to play with David Lee Roth, but you passed it up.
Oh yeah,
and
true.
Becker. True. Okay. And I think after that, this was way after Megadeth, correct?
Yeah, it was. Probably about 4 years after Megadeth. And I wanted to mention, you know, that teacher was one part of it.
Yeah.
And you asked me about my transition to GIT, and I'll just finish that and lead into the David Lee Roth story. You know, I played all over the Midwest region, and there's, at a point you realize there's only so far you can go. And all of us back then were reading Guitar Player magazines, which I actually bought most of them at the Dayton Band, where I was taking lessons with Bob Schroyer. And my mom was so cool to drive me each way, an hour every week, an hour each way. And she'd have to sit there for the whole lesson. So it really helps when you have a parent who's supportive. And then flash forward, I had a Guitar Player magazine, and I remember it was just a one-page article about GIT. Musicians Institute. And I read about the teachers. It had a picture of the class, and the graduating class that year was not that big. It was a very small school above the Hollywood Wax Museum that's long since moved. Hollywood, the complexion of that street, it's where Hollywood and Highland is. Yeah. It looks totally different today than it was. It's a totally different Hollywood than when I moved there in March of 84 to go to GIT. And it was an amazing school. But to be honest, I feel like The students that went in there that had something were the ones that were successful. And it's not like that school was going to change your life. And actually, I didn't really attend. I kind of skipped out on the last half of the year because I met a drummer who had an amazing studio. And we were already recording at this huge studio where Michael Jackson and Toto and Quincy Jones and Barbara Streisand and all these people were recording. So I just went to my tests and I was getting A's on my tests. I still have my curriculum from GIT to this day. It's about that thick.
Oh, wow.
And I still can refer back to it. But it was just, it puts you in that environment, the school, because then you're working full time, 14, 15, 16 hours a day, every waking minute. You know, I didn't have a date. I didn't go out to the Rainbow. A lot of kids went out to GIT and they just went out to the whiskey and the clubs and they drank and they partied and they acted like rock stars before they earned it.
Right.
And I just locked myself, you know, you go a little crazy when you don't have any, friends or female contact. But I think that's what it takes. And, you know, I got the Megadeth gig and we went through that. And after I left Megadeth, I was trying to put a band together. And we did a demo. We had a 4-song demo. And my drummer, who had played with Andy Taylor from Duran Duran, left Duran Duran and did a hard rock album that's actually really killer. He got inspired by Van Halen and left Duran Duran. And he was kind of trying to get in that vibe of the Van Halen guitar sound. And he was singing it. It's a really great, there's a great single called I Might Lie. People should check that video out. It's a great tune. And my drummer is on that song and on that record. And he happened to know this lawyer in Hollywood named Chuck Horowitz. We met with him. He loved our demo. So he started shopping it around Hollywood to different management companies for us. And there were two that came back that really caught our ear. One was Fitzgerald Hartley, who managed Toto and Quincy Jones, which was cool. And they also make all the gold albums. So they took us on a tour of their offices, showed us how they made all the gold albums. And that was pretty seductive and tempting.
Right.
But the other option was Pete Angelus and Patrick Whitley, who had just come out of Van Halen and they were managing David Lee Roth. Pete Angelus was the guy that directed Just a Gigolo, California Girls videos. He's in the 7-Eleven and Gigolo. He's the slick back Italian guy that Roth runs into.
I love the one.
And during the time they managed me, they also picked up Black Crowes, and I think they did all right for them. So there was a point when we were, it's a long story short, but our singer got deported back to Sweden. We had this great singer. It was kind of like a cross between David Coverdale and I don't know who he had. He had just a great voice and great look. And we had Jeff Scott Soto, oddly enough, since David Elson is working with him, do all the harmonies. Like Soto came in and did 40 tracks of harmonies, like Def Leppard Journey style, and it sounded great. And our singer got deported back to Sweden. He missed his girlfriend. He went back there and had trouble getting back in the country. So now here's our band. We had Phil Chasson from Ozzy, Rock Shot in the Dark on bass, Jonathan Vallon on drums, and no singer. So I almost had Oney Logan, but he got swooped up by George Lynch for Lynch Mob. Then we went after Pete Angelus and Patrick. We tried to go after John Corabi, who was in The Scream, and I loved him. Back then, I saw him at FM station in the Valley. He played in a band called Angora, and he was incredible. He was like Steven Tyler beyond his charisma, a thicker voice. He was just, everyone was like,
right.
He was amazing. So I tried to get, and he didn't want to leave The Scream because they had that song Man on the Moon or Man in the Moon on the radio. I think they had another song on the radio. And that was the X Racer X guys, was his band. It was John and the Racer X drummer, bass player, etc. And I remember sitting in Pete's office. He said, Jeff, I don't think we're going to get John Corabi, man. Motley Crue's trying to get him right now.
Oh, yeah.
They offered him a Harley Davidson. He ain't leaving the screen.
You're right.
So eventually, Motley went back with, you know, a large check, and the rest is history. And that's my favorite Motley Crue album. John's just amazing. Yeah, such a cool cat. I ran into him years later, and we talked about it. He's just the coolest ever, and I'm so glad that he's still out doing it, and people should really support him and his music. But so, cut to the chase, here I am with no singer, and my band sitting in my living room one night, and the phone rings, and it's Pete Angelus, and he says, David wants you to go over to his house in Pasadena right now. We played him your demo, and he wants you to replace Steve Vai.
And you're like, what? I don't know if I can, dude.
I just said, Brad, my drummer's sitting here. Didn't I just say, I said to someone this week, maybe I regret, we were looking today. I literally just said it an hour ago because Steve Vai's house is on sale.
Yeah.
And just watching the video walkthrough of Steve Vai's house. And I said, maybe I made the wrong decision back then when I passed on that rock, dude. But like everyone knows his live singing, it just like, I really said, I think he's going to end up in Vegas. And back then, Vegas wasn't cool. It was kind of where, you know, musicians went to die, you know?
Yeah.
And I heard he was maybe hard to work with. And since then, I've heard he's even harder to work with than that, because I've met guys who did the Vegas residency. I played with them at the Van Halen thing. So, I mean, we know he's a lunatic, dude. I mean, that's straight from his band.
That's
my ear. Yeah. So I just, as much as it was tempting and following Eddie, you know, having those comparisons and Steve, I wanted to do my own thing and my own music, and I just passed on it. So today, again, I'm regretting it after seeing that walkthrough on the Steve house for sale in California, but there you go.
Hell yeah. Yeah, David, Roth is kind of out there, but I mean, he's a great entertainer. I mean, you can't deny that fact at all. You know,
you want to know something cool? I don't know. You've probably seen the Jason Becker documentary.
I think I have.
Yeah. Jason, you should check it out. Everyone should check it out. It's a beautiful movie. And I don't know if everyone knows the story. And a cool aside is when I passed on the gig, Jason Becker from Cacophony, and he played with Marty Friedman, which is strange, you know, because of the connection with Marty and I. I was in Pete Angelus' office another day, and he said, well, Jason Becker's going to do the gig, so it's cool. He said, but he can't play blues. You know, he was more like the neoclassical kind of Yngwie Shredder, Shrapnel Records, Mike Varney trip. So he said, he told me they sent him up in the Hollywood Hills to study with Steve Hunter. And the minute, and Pete, that might be lost on many of your listeners until I clarify who Steve Hunter is. Steve Hunter's the guy who plays on the first half of Train Kept Rollin' on Get Your Wings by Aerosmith. That's not Brad Whitford or Joe Perry on the track.
Oh, okay.
There was a guitar duo in the 70s. Dick Wagner was one, and Steve Hunter was the other. They were the guys that played with Alice Cooper on Welcome to My Nightmare, and my favorite Alice Cooper album, Goes to Hell. The Hollywood Vampires was the band on Goes to Hell. He already had that name back in the 70s that he's revamped all these years later. And Steve and Dick were the Hollywood Vampires. Steve played with Lou Reed on the Rock and Roll Animal, Sweet Jane you hear on the radio. He played Salisbury Hill, the 12-string guitar for Peter Gabriel. But mostly, when I was a kid figuring out those licks off Train Kept Rollin', by the way, the second half when it gets fast and it sounds like there's a live audience, the fast shredding is Dick Wagner. And they just happened to be recording with Alice Cooper in the studio next door, and Jack Douglas said, you want to come and play on the Aerosmith album? Because he didn't feel Joe and Brad were quite ready to do this Yardbirds remake. So that when I heard that Jason was studying with Steve, I was like, I want to study with Steve Hunter. And I was so fast up in the Highwood Hills to Steve Hunter's house, and I took many blues lessons with Steve. And what an amazing teacher. And him and Jason went on to become friends, and they co-wrote a lot of the music for David's album, A Little Ain't Enough. And when I watched Jason's movie, you know, I've seen it a few times, but I think the third time I saw it, it finally dawned. I'm so glad I passed on that gig.
Okay.
Because that was the only chance Jason had to make a major label album and have that beautiful experience before he lost the ability to play guitar at all. I don't know if people got it. He got Lou Gehrig's disease, and he's in a wheelchair and can't move, but still composes. By his father is a computer genius and invented a machine whereby moving his eyes, he can talk, and he still can compose and have other players perform, or he can have the music performed, you know, with a computer that. So what an amazing story. So I actually broke into tears and realized that everything works out, and it was Jason's destiny to do that gig. And I went on to do the Brazilian album, and I lived in Brazil, you know, for 4.5 years and had an amazing experience touring the world, even to farther reaches than I was able to with Megadeth. I played opening for amazing artists like Joe Cocker and Cassandra Wilson, the amazing jazz singer, and played some amazing festivals, opened for some amazing Brazilian artists. And by that time, I was heavy into Brazilian music and flamenco, because once you study classical, and many jazz players get into Brazilian music, because the Brazilian guitar players are just incredible, as are flamenco players, because each country has, it's what we call folk music, right? Or our blues, or the Americana, the Appalachian music. Spain has flamenco, right? And they also have gypsy jazz, which evolved in the Moulin Rouge. Flamenco is more from the south of Spain and the Andalusian region. But Brazil has an amazing style of music called chordinho, which is based around nylon string guitar and a bandolin, which is, Americans know it as a mandolin. And it's very hard to play, as is flamenco. So when you study classical guitar, many, you know, you often branch out.
Yeah, that's really amazing. Yeah, because Jason Becker is a sight to behold, you know. And I did watch the documentary. You were reminding me. That's a beautiful documentary too.
What a story!
What a unique guy. Yes, sir.
And you can't imagine to be able to have the ability to play guitar like that and then have it just taken away from you.
Right, yeah.
And then you still have to live your whole life. I mean, what a thing to get over, a spiritual thing to conquer in his lifetime. Yeah. But I love Jason, and we were becoming friends. I'd see him at the NAMM show, and we have a very similar temperament and personality. Dedication to guitar. So we were becoming friends at that time, and right before he got the Roth gig. So it was really sad what happened with him. You know, we all love him and his playing, and I listen to all his albums, are amazing.
Right. Yeah. I've been listening to, ever since I knew you were coming on the show, I had to look you up. And I've been listening to this album called Chameleon by your wife, correct?
Oops, say it again.
The album Chameleon. You know.
Oh, Chameleon?
Yeah.
By Giasaggi.
Yeah.
I know her name is funny to pronounce. Like when I first read it as a gringo, as an American, I thought it was Body Assad.
I did too.
Because it's Badassad, and that's, an American would read that, Body Assad.
Right.
She's half Brazilian and half Lebanese. And Baji is just a Lebanese nickname, and her mother always called her Baji.
Yeah.
And then her brothers, Sergio and Odai Asaji, are renowned as the greatest classical guitar duo in history. They played with Yo-Yo Ma, the cellist. Highly recommend people, if you love guitar music and you don't know Sergio and Odai Asaji, you should really research them. And Sergio, everyone knows how to spell Odair, is Assad, just like air we breathe, Odai.
Yeah.
Assad, A-S-S-A-D, Assadji is how they pronounce it. They're just, they studied together since they were 8 and 9 years old, and they were like on the Ed Sullivan or the Tonight Show Brazil from children to adults. And because their father played Chordinho mandolin, and he needed someone to accompany him, and he forced his children to play nylon string guitar, and now they've gone in. He moved them to Rio de Janeiro to study with one of Andre Segovia's proteges. He moved the whole family. And it's amazing when you have a parent like that that's so supportive and gets the children the tutelage that they need, because they come from the countryside of São João de Boa Vista outside São Paulo. It's a beautiful but not a very rich place. But when you go to Brazil, I found, because a lot of the family unit is broke down in America, a lot of divorces, over 60%.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It was amazing to see a family unit, the father and the mother in their 70s, all the children, the relatives, the neighbors come over, the father in his 70s teaching the neighborhood kids how to play nylon string guitar. Maybe someday one of these kids will go on to become a great guitar player. So what an amazing experience to be around this musical family and sit at the feet. And it's just a strange thing because, you know, countries have styles of music, and the media is what exposes you to most of the music that you hear. So most people don't hear some of the best music in the world from other cultures. But as I've traveled the world, and especially getting more into world music, you know, I made a point to collect world music. And when you go to play in a region, you ask the record company represent, who are the hottest bands from your region? And maybe the record company guy even gives you a few of the albums off your label of these bands that are signed out of their country.
Right.
That they've signed out of their region. So we've learned about all these amazing different bands, and Brazil has just so many amazing influence. My mother's favorite song was Girl from Ipanema, and that we all know that as Americans, but the more you study it and you realize the different rhythms and styles and innovation, the bossa nova and the samba and the, you know, all the different styles of music, it's just amazing. And that's, again, from a young kid, I always liked all styles of music. I wasn't ever like, it's got to be metal or die, or it's got to be blues, or, and even there's flamenco players that, when Paco de Lucia, the greatest flamenco player, started bringing jazz in or different styles into the music, or collaborating with Al Di Meola and John McLaughlin, flamenco purists were like, he's ruining flamenco. He's ruining flamenco. But that's where new music comes from. There's been so many great artists in history that have written so many great songs that some genres, I mean, where do new songs come from? Sometimes by bringing different styles and fusing, that's where new music is born. You're like making a jambalaya. And it's not only cool to mix, I think, different styles, what you realize, like after living in Brazil, I'll give you an example. There's a rhythm from the northeast of Brazil called cavaquinho. It's a drum rhythm. It's talan, 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 talan. And it's played on folk instruments and different Brazilian instruments, pandeiro, which is like a Brazilian tambourine, and a banambau that looks like a bow and arrow, and they play it with, it's, you got to check out a banambau. It's just a trippy instrument. It's like got a gourd on it. It looks like a bow and arrow, and they play it with a stick and a coin. And the rhythm is galloping, and it's called cavaquinho. It's a traditional Brazilian folk rhythm. But when an American, as an American, I hear that, I go, it's Run to the Hills by Iron Maiden.
Yes. Yeah.
So what you realize by studying different styles of music and traveling as a musician, and even sitting in a restaurant in Paris and looking around at lunch, and you realize, or in Spain, and everyone's getting ready for the siesta, and you look around, what everyone wants is, you know, to wake up and have good food and clean air and good friends and family and loved ones and great music, right? and to dance. And I mean, that's really what it's all about. And the more you blend music and the more styles you study, you realize not how different people and cultures are, you realize how similar they are. Just like the story I just told you, there's this Brazilian rhythm. It's a folk rhythm and it sounds like Run to the Hills. It's metal. The only difference is one's played on these folk instruments and one's played through Marshall Stacks cranked on 11.
Right. Yeah.
When you study flamenco, you realize what a relation, because it's very danceable and you're playing these rhythms with the right hand. You go, man, this is really funky. Flamenco and funk have some kind of a kinship. So the more you can blend things, and then you, hopefully listeners, when they listen to a record, they realize that, and they, when they hear this kind of fusion, they realize that we are all one. Like Bob Marley said, we're one.
We're one, yeah.
One love, you know, one life. Let's get together and be all right. It'll be all right. I feel that with music. And Bob Marley's a huge influence. I love bringing reggae. And there's reggae influences on my records and stuff by G and I did. We love to mix reggae. I went to where Bob Marley was born in the jungles of Jamaica. I went to where his studio in Tuff Gong and where he lived in Kingston, which is a scary town to go to. But I went even scary out 4.5 hours out in the jungle. And if you don't believe in destiny, you go to where Bob Marley was born, because his mother could not have dropped him farther in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah.
To become the most played artist on this planet. Wherever you go, like when you're in an exotic, like Jamaica or Bermuda or Punta Cana, Hawaii, you're not hearing Elvis or the Beatles, some Elvis in Hawaii, but you're hearing Bob Marley everywhere you go in the world.
Oh, yeah.
Everywhere you go.
Yep.
And it's just a miracle when you see, how did that man go from there to where he went and bring that message to so many people, just such a positive, uplifting message. And it's a bit of a tragedy that he's been a little bit reduced to like a brand and, you know, about marijuana and marketing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when he's one of the genius lyricists, composers, and he innovated a style of music that, like, when I hear reggae, it's, for me, it's almost got to be Bob Marley or no one when it comes to reggae.
There you go. I mean, because he's one of the major pioneers. Yeah. But going back to the album Chameleon with you and Baji, since she's did it, how easy or hard was it to create the album? Because she's bringing stuff from her country, and you're bringing stuff from yours, America. And so, was that like a collective work of art, or did you bang heads sometimes with it? You know,
it was a trip how we met, and it was magic. It was through a guitar maker who was making me a classical guitar, and it just so happened her brothers played his brand of guitar. But she didn't even play this guy's guitar. And when I met her, she didn't speak as good of English as she did once we started dating and became around each other all the time. When I met her, she didn't know who Yes was. I started talking to her about Yes and Bjork.
And
artists like Tori Amos. And I was telling her, you remind me in the same frequency as Bjork and Tori Amos. And you could do what these artists are doing. She didn't know any of these artists. And we were having a little bit of communication. But music is, again, it's what unites people. And it tears down all along. We were both guitarists. And once she heard these artists and she realized, she ended up covering both Tori Amos and Bjork on her albums later in her career. And I really feel great about that because I inspired her with those artists. But I was already into Brazilian music. And for me, it was an education to be able to be around these Brazilian musicians and the musicians that they knew, percussionists like Marco Suzano, who, like, when Sting goes to Brazil and he needs a percussionist, they're like, Marco Susano.
Right.
He plays a tambourine and makes it sound like a whole drum set. It's incredible, the guy. And so to be able to go into this world of all these different musicians, and some you didn't even speak the same language, but somehow they go, you're in the production chair and they're behind the glass in the tracking room, and somehow you're making beautiful music together. You don't need to speak the same language. So it was a beautiful learning experience for me. And I just immersed myself in Brazil.
Right.
Music. And then when I was into flamenco, because back when I was mentioning Steve Howe and Steve Morrison, Eddie Van Halen and Randy, I discovered, because a lot of guitarists, we discovered Paco de Lucia through the trio album, John McLaughlin and Al Di Meola. And when I heard that, I loved flamenco from age 16. When I heard the Passion, Grace and Fire album with the trio, it was their studio album. They also have Friday Night in San Francisco, which is the most popular that all the musicians rave about. But I love the studio album. It's beautiful. And so when Baji and I went to Spain, I fell deeply, and it's just a natural thing. Flamenco is played on a nylon string guitar in Brazilian music. Almost every house in Brazil has a nylon string guitar. Mm-hmm. Every party at the end, they break out and someone's picking up one or five or six nylon string guitars are playing every night. And it's a jam, and it's just normal there. You don't see so much of that at the end of a party breaking out into, you know, a folky jam in America, but it's just an amazing thing. So I immersed myself in it. And the more I was around it, just like language, the more I could speak and understand. And then same with the hands and the music, the more you're around it, the more and then you just take it in. And so now you have, it's just like a palette that an artist has with all the colors. So now I got rock, blues, jazz, classical,
everything.
Brazilian. Yeah. And then when you're writing, you just take your paintbrush and then you just splash paint on the canvas.
Yes. Perfect. Yeah.
And that's how it was with Baji. And as the artists would come in, these different world music artists, they're also good that you don't tell them what to play. You just tell them splash paint on canvas. And 99% of the time, what they play out of their intuition is more than you could have ever dreamed up. And it takes the song somewhere else. Magical that, you know, it takes a village to raise a song, to make a song and raise a band. It you know, it's a whole team thing.
It's during your whole music career, what part of your musicianship do you think gets misunderstood because of your thrash label? You know, because talking to you right now, you have a beautiful soul. I hear you talk about flamenco and all of these different styles. What's that part of your musicianship that you think gets misunderstood by all the fans and everybody else?
I never really think about it. What's most misunderstood about my style?
Yeah.
I think, well, this is the thing. A lot of people weren't even born that are into Megadeth now a lot of people come to me through Megadeth and they only know, it's just like in acting, you get stereotyped.
Yes.
So yeah. I'm a little bit stereotyped right now because most people, there's a million people that bought that album. It went platinum. So there's a million plus people that have So Far, So Good, So What. And there was a weird merger in Universal Music and Polygram, and it all got bought up the month Chameleon came out. So a lot of people in America didn't hear about Chameleon, even though it went number one in Europe and charted, the single charted above Madonna in Holland. There was a huge swirl. What everyone knows as Universal Music today was really Seagram's Whiskey from Canada came in and bought Polygram Records, which was our label and every subsidiary, and Universal Motion Pictures, and made this big monster. And every band on that had released an album got lost in the shuffle, from Janet Jackson to Extreme to just so many bands. Bob Marley was under that. I mean, the Island Records, Chris Blackwell's label, who discovered Bob Marley and Melissa Etheridge and many more artists. All these are Herb Albert A&M. So a lot of people in America never heard Chameleon, don't know about it. They just know me from one thing.
Megadeth, right? Yeah.
And that's great. And now here I am doing it again.
Right.
But, you know,
but
Chameleon, I think when they hear my new album, they're going to get a better picture when the new album Revolutions comes out. But the thing was, a lot of people that are into Megadeth today weren't alive or going to concerts when we toured.
Yeah.
And they either got them into Rust in Peace, you know, Cryptic Writings. What's the other big album for Megadeth? Symphony of Destruction.
Countdown.
Countdown to Extinction. Like for Kiko told Dave when he got Megadeth that, you know, the big album in Brazil when they first heard about Megadeth was Euthanasia. So people came in at different, a lot of people never heard me. So it's not really a misconception. They just don't know me. So with Kings of Thrash, they're hearing me for the first time. And when they see it, they're seeing it for the first time. They're, oh, I get it. And so it's really just a matter of letting people get to know me now through this touring and when the new album comes out. And I think any misconceptions or just like holes in the story where people don't understand the full scope of my musicianship will all be cleared up in short order.
Yeah.
So I don't really sweat it. I don't really think too much about what people think. Just to be successful in music, you got to stop caring what people think.
Yes.
You can't go up on stage and you're not trying to impress people and how fast can I play. And, you know, that's the main thing that 30 years teaches you in music is it's not about that. Music is to lift people's vibration, to lift people's frequency. I mean, you can bring it down. There's plenty of music out there that brings people down.
Yeah.
Essentially so. I mean, the Hollywood beast system is pumping out music to bring you down. That's what Hollywood is about with the movies today. You see how down, how black and dark everything. I mean, I can't even see the lighting in the movies. Everything's so dark.
I don't know.
What is going on in this movie?
Right.
So music, just like language, the words you speak, it's magic. That's why they call it spelling. It's sigil magic. The words you say. That's why a poet or a lyricist who writes words and strings words together, some have more effect on your spirit than others, because some people know how to work magic with words. Some people know how to work magic with music, right?
Right.
And for me, that's what it's about. And that's the only reason I'm in music is to like have fun and lift people up. I don't want to go out on stage and try to, show how badass I am or have a frown on my face. The best thing about Kings of Thrash show, and it's happened two nights in a row, and we realized this is our mission statement. This is our mantra. The first night a guy came up, he posted a review. Some writer from Toronto said, Kings of Thrash made me feel like a 13-year-old boy again. That's exactly what I needed.
Yes.
And then last night, Fred, me, and Chaz were standing out waiting for the van to pull around. It's totally dark in downtown. There's no one on the streets. One fan came around the corner and he says, I just want to thank you guys because you guys made me feel like I was back in high school tonight. And I said, I told you guys in the text. I texted everybody that morning after it happened. The first, I go, dude, that's our mantra, to make everyone feel like they're 13 again. Because it's that the nostalgia of the people who were there at that time, the reminiscence. But then, and the greatest thing is some of these people are now bringing their kids, their sons, daughters, relatives, you know, nieces, nephews. And now this whole younger generation is getting into this music. And obviously we're playing the deep cuts and the stuff that's more off. And we're doing So Far So Good, So What in its entirety on this run. And we've done Peace Cells in its entirety. We didn't. Yeah, we've done and Killing. We've done Killing in its entirety. So we've done the first three Megadeth in its entirety in different parts of the world, depending on where we're touring.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, to me, I mean,
you're a lot of music to learn. I just thought about that.
I know, right? Yeah. I wonder how you do it. Like, how do you store all these notes in your brain? Because that's what I ask myself.
There's a million of them.
Oh, I know, right? It's got to get complicated sometimes, you know. I mean, but I guess that's what practices this more, right? Yeah.
It's muscle memory for here, and it's just like all we do is play music, you know, every waking minute that we can. And luckily, when I came to Kings of Thrash, luckily I had saved, when I got the Megadeth gig all those years ago, I don't know what possessed me to do this, but there was no YouTube or, you know.
No.
I had a cassette, a Marantz cassette player that I use at GIT to slow down tapes like Yngwie, like the Alcatraz album. Mm-hmm. No Pearl from Rock and Roll. I wanted to figure out Yngwie solos and some of the newest Gary Moore stuff and John Sykes and John Norum stuff that was coming out. So I had this cassette player where you could slow it down to half speed, so it was half as fast, albeit it sounded like a record at 16. We used to deal with a record player. It's a perfect octave lower, so it's the same notes, an octave lower, but like trudging through quicksand. It's a hard way to learn, but it's all we had back then.
So when
I got the Megadeth gig, I had the foresight to ask the guys in the band, I don't know who hooked me up with Capitol Records. I went in the Capitol Records studio with the engineer and he brought in the Megadeth master tapes. And Killing is My Business. And we put the master tapes up and I soloed the whole band, but Chris Poland. So first I soloed all Chris rhythms. So and then we play it. So I have the whole album with just his rhythm guitar. And then I did the same with Killing. So I have a cassette with just Chris Poland's rhythm guitar, a piece, and Killing. And then I flip it over, and then I got just his lead solo, no band, from Killing and Peace. And so I went home, and that's how I learned all his stuff. And by some miracle of happenstance and destiny, and that this was supposed to happen, the Kings of Thrash is a destiny thing. I think Nick Menz is definitely involved with Kings of Thrash and our new single Bullets Ready. I know he's involved in that because I wrote it to his drum beats, but it was just a magical thing how the whole thing manifested. And here we are. I had those tapes. I saved them with, I don't know how many times I've moved since 1984 around this country and to Brazil and back. And I still had those tapes of Chris Poland. So when the Kings of Thrash thing came, I took the tapes. Now I put them in my laptop. Now I got all that stuff digital.
Right.
We got better half-speed players now, so I can take it down or speed it up. And I really went back with a fine-tooth magnifying glass, a fine-tooth comb, and went through all Chris's stuff. And I had to learn Dave's stuff, and I did the same with Marty's stuff. And here we are.
Yeah. Nice. Well, I got one more question, and I think you'll enjoy this because I read, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong here, but I read that you prefer analog over digital. Is that still true to you, or do you prefer digital now? You know, because to me, analog and records is like...
You had to open this can of worms, didn't you?
Oh, no. I'm sorry.
I'll nutshell it down because there's a bunch. I talk about this a lot, and I'll talk about it in the liner notes for my new album.
Yeah.
It's this simple, and you can just Google it. Just Google, are humans analog creatures? We are analog creatures. We are meant to input analog intel into our systems. We are not meant to input all this digital information, the Wi-Fi, all this noise and pollution that is in our planet sphere today. So I started this record. This record's taken me because of money. I mean, analog tape, 2-inch tape, imagine a cassette, if everyone knows what old cassettes look like, imagine a tape this big and 2-inch thick, the tape, and you can fit 24 tracks, so you can have the snare drum, every drum on a track, every guitar mic, every vocal mic, every bass, and you know, everything is on a separate track and you can mix it together. It's a lost art. But my hypothesis with the record and in life is that we are analog creatures, and maybe the reason that people don't relate to music as strongly and we're not as obsessed, it's not as much of our consciousness as it was in the 70s when we would wait the day the album comes out, go down to the record store, get the album, read the liner notes. We knew where the studio was, who the engineer, who the session players were. You know, right now it's like background music for most people.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
And they don't even know the artist's name. Who? I'm not good.
Right.
Bands,
yeah.
That's why tribute bands are so popular, because people don't care who's in the band. But we used to. And maybe the reason people don't care is because it's the delivery mechanism. You're getting music that may be from the heart and maybe it's well crafted, but it's delivered in a medium where it's not ever going to touch your soul, because digital splinters your soul. Watch the movie Sound City, Neil Young, they all talk about digital. That's why Dave Grohl wanted that old board out of Sound City. He wanted that old analog board, and I worked in that studio on that board, and it's killer. I have 2-inch tapes from that day that say Sound City still to come out someday in my Jeff Young box set of all my early demos and stuff.
Yes, I can't wait to get it.
So analog tape is $500 a reel. So I wanted to finance the album myself. So doing it at $500 a reel, you know, when you are living your life in expensive California or wherever, you have child support, you know, it's a slow process and you got to pay the musicians. I didn't want to do it through the label.
Yeah.
So some musicians would do it for free because they were my buds, but not everyone would. So, and I'm glad it worked out this way. And I got cancer that somewhere, you know, in there. And I had cancer and one of the other singers got cancer. So there was a whole thing that had to happen. And I'm glad it did, because it allowed me to evolve as a musician. It allowed the songs to evolve. And the players evolved. I met different players. If I were to record the album in a few months or even a year back then, I wouldn't have the same songs, the same players. It would be a totally different record. And now, you know, the same patience is virtue. That's the story of this record. Patience is virtue. And Rome wasn't built overnight. So this is like, it turned out to be a life's work. I didn't mean it to be. It was accidental, but I'm so glad it did, because I've got some of the most amazing players. I don't know how they even crossed my path, and I'm just so blessed. Fred right here from Kings of Thrash is one of them on the album. And I don't know too many drummers that could hold a candle these days to my brother.
Oh, right.
Another brother, the Peruvian hammer, Mr. Achin.
Yeah.
So I invite people to go to lightningrising.com. I know we're winding down, but you can see all the players. It's right on the homepage. Lightningrising.com. That's the opening track on the record. Just fed all the players. James Lomenzo is on there.
Yeah.
And a whole bunch more of amazing musicians that I'm telling people, put me on the back burner for a minute. Forget about me.
Okay.
come for the other players.
Yeah.
And it's so amazing to hear them in maybe a context that you wouldn't normally expect them to play this style of music. And that's what's so fun, is to have a jazz player maybe play a heavy metal song and see how they would interpret it, or vice versa. So I think it's just a real fun album. And it's called Revolutions, like a turntable, but it's E is capital because it's my evolution. It's the evolution of my songwriting, my playing, my musical friendships. And I thought about this, just it's the evolution of the recording industry. And audiophiles can listen, because the way I recorded when I started the album over a decade ago, and the means and the technology we had, even digitally,
yeah,
is totally different than today, because digital is a lot more analog sounding today. They're aping it, they're imitating it better. So I think it's a real cool journey, and I hope people will check it out, lightningrising.com.
All right. Yes. And before you go, you are on tour now until September, correct?
We're on tour, 5 dates in the U.S., and that's the... We got no more foreseeable Kings of Thrash dates in the U.S. for
the year,
unless some surprise comes up, because we're mostly booked. We're going later this month, Colombia. Then we got U.K., Ireland.
Norway.
Then Norway. That'll take us out to October, right?
Yeah.
Norway's, we've never played Norway, so.
It's first, then U.K.
Oh, Norway's first, then U.K., Ireland, sorry.
Okay. Yeah, it gets confusing, right?
I know. It's totally Greenland. Yeah,
exactly. So, but Jeff, I do love you like a brother, and I beg you to come back anytime you want to. I know you're be busy.
Thank you. I appreciate it. And your intro, I'm still thinking about that intro. I'm going to recommend all my listeners, friends, followers to check out the thing, because that was a beautiful... You can tell you wrote out and put some thought into that intro. I appreciate that.
I'm actually going to tell Sharna to give you my number, because I would love to keep in contact with you if you don't mind.
Oh, for sure.
I love you.
I'll come back. We can talk more as the album's getting done. Yeah. I got two songs to finish. The day before we left on tour, the song Fred is on the record. I was doubling the guitars and doing some like Brian May Boston harmony stacking guitars at the end. It's super... It's the heaviest track on the record now.
Nice.
It's pretty cool. And I would urge folks to go check out a song by the band Sons of Texas. The singer's name's Mark Morales, and the song's called Baptized in the Rio Grande. He's the singer on the track, and he's a beast, dude.
Gotta love
it. So good. He's like Phil from Pantera, but more of a singer meets Lace Staley, but he can sing. I saw a video of him singing Skynyrd Simple Band in a shitty club in Texas, and it made me cry. I mean, this guy's like a salt of the earth vocalist. He sings like a man.
There you go.
He sings like a dude. He's fucking killer.
Yeah.
Baptized in the Rio Grande. I think that might be the first single, because it's just coming out so good. Mm. And I got Gabriel Connor from Red Devil Vortex.
There you go. Right.
We didn't talk about that yet. Bullets ready, people. Have you heard the new Kings of Thrash song and video?
That's right. Yeah.
So Gabriel's in my solo band with Fred, and me and Gabriel, we're doing kind of a Rush power trio thing. We got some singers that sit in as well. And that's kind of how Gabriel came into the thing, because he was playing with my band, and we eventually had his band Red Devil Vortex come out opening for Kings of Thrash, and Ace Frehley died.
Yeah.
I'm going to drop something on your show, a little something coming out in a week or two. It's getting mixed right now. Ace died, and Gabriel's a huge Kiss fan. So every night on the tour, we did Cold Gin for the encore.
And I love
Red
Cold,
Devil Vortex. They did a multi-track recording, and we're going to release Cold Gin live from our tour. I forget what city it was, but with Gabriel and Chaz duetting and all of us singing together and the whole audience. The video came out really cool, so that should be out in a week or two.
Hell yeah.
But everybody, check out Bullets Ready. We're pretty stoked about it.
Yeah, Bullets Ready of a new thing. Yes, check it out.
Because it's prog punk, man. Who fuses prog and punk and thrash? And it's everything's in there. It's a jambalaya.
You know who mixes those? Geniuses mixes those.
Who?
Geniuses.
Yeah.
Geniuses.
True.
Yes, you're a genius. Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Oh, geniuses.
Geniuses,
I thought that was a band that I had to go.
No,
I was about to go check out.
No, not geniuses. No, not geniuses. Geniuses. Yeah.
There's some part. Listen to the part, like, especially my guitar solo and Bullets Ready. And there's some parts. I was totally thinking Ramones when I wrote that.
Okay.
Listen to that. It's totally like early Ramones.
Yeah,
we love, and that's the cool thing. I think music is such a, it's like, who wants to eat the same ice cream every day? Yes, and proggy bands and King Crimson and ELP, Fred's Awareness. I'm doing a remake of Still You Turn Me On off Brain Solid Surgery. That's going to be beautiful with this Moog player that has the whole Keith Emerson wall of Moogs. And I love that stuff, but I also love the Pistols and Ramones. So I urge people to broaden their horizons, because there's a lot of great music out in this world. and you want to drink it all in while we got it, because it's a gift.
Yes, sir.
And it was a gift being on your show. Thank you so much, brother.
The honor is all mine, because this is a dream come true for me, you know.
And thanks for coming on our tour bus. Let me give you the quick pan.
Yes. Hey. Hello. How you doing?
And there's Fred.
Fred, right there. But what's up, Fred?
Yeah. The Peruvian Hammer and Gravel Dudes, our opening band and brothers. Yeah. From another mother.
There you go.
All right, man. I'll hit you on the flip side.
Yeah, sir.
Send me your number. We'll stay in contact and let me know when this is live, and I'll share it all around. We'll share it everywhere.
I will do. Yes, sir. Thank you so much for coming on. Thank you so much for listening. And always remember, when words fail, music speaks. Bye, guys.